All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of California. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court, sitting in bank, is now in session.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We regret starting late, but we had a full morning and always need the noon hour to conference and vote on the three morning cases. So we're ready to proceed on this afternoon's calendar and welcome. The clerk will call the calendar.
For the Supreme Court of California holding oral argument in special session in Santa Barbara, California on Tuesday, October 3rd, 2006 at 2 p.m. is as follows. Case number S130717, Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company, plaintiff and respondent B. Blanca Montez Harris et al., defendant and appellants, and companion case. Question of law for the appellants. Blanca Montez Harris, Mr. Abel. For appellant Javier Cortez, Mr. St. George, and for the respondent, Mr. Green, Jr. Case number S130080, the people plaintiff and appellant, the Manuel Alex Trujillo, defendant and appellant. For the appellant, Trujillo, Mr. Presser. And for the appellant, the people, Mr. McCarroll.
We'll proceed initially in the matter of Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance versus Blanca Montes Harris. Hearing first from Mr. Abel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Bruce Abel appearing on behalf of petitioners Blanca Montes Harris, Monica Arredondo, and Camille Tony Harris. Your Honors, this question that has been certified by the Ninth Circuit and you have agreed to accept on whether or not an insurer has a duty to insure, to investigate the insurability of an insured as recognized in Barrera when it issues an excess liability policy in a rental car context should be answered yes, and it should be answered yes for a number of reasons. I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
Did Barrera involve a rental car company or the context of a rental car?
No, it didn't.
Does that make a difference in your view?
No, it doesn't. Not at all. And the reason why it doesn't make a difference is because of the underlying philosophy and the analysis of Barrera are true. They're not limited in any way to a primary insurer. And there isn't anything that is in Barrera that specifically identified that its holding is restricted to primary insurers.
Let me ask you this question. Now, the vehicle code section sets forth the steps that a rental car company should take in terms of inspecting the license, et cetera. And I take it your position is that the process must be more exhaustive than that as far as the excess insurer is concerned. Is that correct?
I would say that it's not synonymous or equivalent to what the obligations of a quasi-public entity has. The vehicle code sections, I believe Your Honor is referring to, our vehicle code section 14604 and 14608. They deal specifically with the rental car or owners who rent cars. And the obligation for a rental car company is not to investigate, but to inspect the license. By the sheer plain meaning of inspect, which is to simply maybe a look at officially or to look at carefully, that is quite different from the common meaning to investigate, which is a detailed, systematic inquiry. There's nothing that, since Barrera, that the courts, that the legislature has done to amend the statutes pertaining to what a rental car company has to do and insert that this also applies to an automobile liability insurer in that context.
What would, I take it that, that in your view, the insurer, and as I understand it, the rental car agent, in effect, offers the insurance. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay. So when we talk about the insurance company versus the rental car company, we're really talking about the person behind the desk servicing the people that are in line for rental cars. I guess one question I have is if, as a matter of practice or as a matter of law, on every rental car transaction, there be an attempt made to access the California Department of Motor Vehicles website in order to determine whether the license that's been presented is still valid. My question is the system capable of that? Or do we know whether the system is even capable of that? If at any time during the day, every rental agent in the state of California is accessing the website in an attempt to get the most up-to-date information possible?
The answer is there are difficulties with that scenario. In fact, there are difficulties even beyond what Your Honor has presented because under the rental car obligations, rental car companies are actually renting cars not only from people from the United States but from around the world. And so the obligation to do some investigation to determine the validity of the driver's license is actually even heightened in the rental car context because in order to ensure protection to the innocent injured victims, we are dealing with a much broader group of people and difficulties with locating those people in the event of a serious accident, tracking them down, involving them in a lawsuit, being able to recover from them. There could be issues of treaty. There could be issues of whether or not that our a judgment here would be enforceable in another country. So what I would say is that, no, not all information that the insurer would need to get would be available from the DMV. The California is part of a driver's license compact, which includes 45 states. Five states are not included. So there would be some issue with regard to getting records because those states are not cooperating or entering into this compact. I would answer the question also with the fact that not all rental car transactions take place immediately upon the person arriving at the front counter. In our day, many people make reservations for car rentals, and there is additional time. But what happens in this case is that in every single case that someone qualifies for a rental car, they are offered and solicited, do you want excess liability? $1 million for some fee, $10 a day or whatever it is. And that sounds awfully good. There are no, and in this record, there was no indication that the rental car clerk said, by the way, if your license isn't any good, you won't have that insurance. As a matter of fact, it's likely that the insurance company wouldn't want such disclosures made at the outset of the transaction and told them exactly what they do. We offer the insurance, we collect the premium, we take no action, and if there's no accident, we keep the premium. If there's an accident, we look into it. We put our whole staff to work to do that.
Well, I guess my question is, if the person renting the car presents his own driver's license. I mean, we're not talking about a minor coming in with the license of an elderly adult where things don't match up. As I understand it, in this case, it was the victim's license that was actually presented.
That's correct.
Correct?
Yes.
And the license itself was facially valid, was it not?
That's correct, it was.
I mean, we're not talking about a license that has been stamped, revoked, or suspended, or whatever. So the vehicle code provisions have been satisfied. Is that a fair statement as far as the rental car company is concerned?
Well, I would answer that provisionally yes, with one qualification. Vehicle Code Section 14608 has two parts. One, that the rental car company cannot rent to someone unless they have the valid license. And secondly, they have another duty, and that is to inspect the license and compare the signature on the license to the signature on the contract. A violation of Vehicle Code Section 14608, one, is an infraction. However, a violation of Vehicle Code Section 14604A is a misdemeanor. So actually, the statutes have to be read together. And although 14604B does not require a rental car company to check with the DMV, it does still require, when the statutes are read together, that they make some reasonable attempt to determine whether or not the license is valid. And so my answer is that simply looking at a license and comparing the signature is not an investigation. It is simply one aspect of an inspection.
What do they have to do precisely?
Well, what I would propose are two things. One is at least some limited type of investigation, asking certain questions that might have eliminated some issues so that the insurer could have some information upon which to make a decision on what...
I mean, should they be asking, is this really a valid license the way it appears to be, or was it suspended? You didn't know?
I would presume that if someone was intentionally trying to misrepresent, then the answer to the question would be a lie. But questions can be asked such as, have you moved without notifying the DMV within the last year? Now, if that question was asked, it would do two things. One, for someone that had forgotten, said, no, I didn't notify the DMV, we wouldn't be in this situation because Mr. Burke, in our case, moved without notifying the DMV. Now, that may not be sufficient, but there are other questions that could be asked. Has your license ever been suspended? Have you ever driven under the influence? And if any of those questions are answered yes, then the insurer can make a decision whether or not that criteria for insurability has been met. In our case, they don't do anything.
But why should we assume that somebody who's going to tender a suspended license is going to give accurate information when the presentation of a suspended license is reflective of a desire to deceive?
Well, the code doesn't require an intention, whether one knows or doesn't know, it's the same result. So,
but, I mean, why should we assume the person is going to give answers in response to this investigatory effort if the person has already indicated his or her desire not to provide relevant information by providing a suspended license?
I don't know that you can necessarily assume that the answer will be honest. In fact, I think the reality of the circumstances are that we know that people may lie. We have jury instructions that deal with people getting up on the witness stand, raising their right hand, being sworn to tell the truth, and then we're given instructions how to determine whether that person's really telling the truth.
But in a trial, there's a lawyer conducting cross-examination of a witness whose testimony may or may not be accurate. Are you envisioning a circumstance in which the nice lady behind the rental car counter is going to start cross-examining people as to whether or not they've ever had a drink and driven?
No, what I was simply pointing out is that our community and our law recognizes that when people are sworn to tell the truth. They sometimes lie.
Well, great, but we're still struggling with what you are asking us to write in terms of the rule. What are you urging us to say the nice lady behind the counter has to do in order to satisfy the rule that you're urging upon us?
At least ask some preliminary questions. And then the insurance company does not have to offer insurance to everyone. But if it does, in the context of a rental car transaction where perhaps they don't have additional time or it would be extremely costly to make an investigation, then they don't have to offer insurance. This is insurance that is voluntarily being offered. And when it is, they are assuming a risk. Insurance companies assume a risk for pay. And one of the risks that they have to assume in this context is that the information provided that the person has a valid driver's license, that's not correct. So what we're doing is we are imposing a duty on the insurance company in those limited cases where someone may have lied. And we do that because there is a greater public importance of protecting innocent injured people who have suffered grave injuries or serious injuries. And that principle, that burden of imposing some duties on an insurance company exists whether it's in the rental car context or some other context. We do have computers. Things are quicker. Supreme Court has its own website now. You can access briefs. You can listen to archived oral arguments. So we know that information is more readily available. In this case, it was. The police were able to determine that Ulrich Burke's license was suspended right at the scene of the accident.
How long ago was it? 2 months before?
Pardon me?
When was the suspension?
The suspension was 2 months
prior. Well, what if it had been 2 weeks or 1 week? I mean, how up-to-date do they have to be on this, and how up-to-date information would they be able to get?
Actually, there would be a problem, because even if a person's license is suspended and they have notified the DMV, the notice is sent to the correct address, but they didn't receive it, they're on the road, or some other reason that they didn't actually receive it, they may not know. So we're going to be in a situation where someone is presenting a license and an insurance company is saying, if you have a license, that's all we care about, and we will take no other investigation, and we'll collect the premium and keep the premium. And that seems to me to be wrong if they're going to offer it to everyone. What the court ought to say is, if you're going to issue excess liability insurance, this is a voluntary insurance, but once it's in place, there are duties that inure to the motoring public. If it does do that, then it has essentially waived the right to rescind because it's issued a policy in the face of inadequate information, knowing that.
The opposite effect. In other words, if a prospective renter knows that he's going to have to answer a number of questions in addition to presenting his driver's license in order to get the excess insurance, he may very well be motivated to say, I don't have time for that. I've got meetings to get to, and I've got to get this car. And so therefore, it would have the result of hurting innocent people because he would otherwise have purchased the excess insurance. It seems to me that these are judgment calls that the legislature has already made, balancing the interest of people being able to rent cars on a prompt basis without standing in lines similar to DMV lines where it takes forever to get a license renewed or something of that sort.
Well, I would respond, but your time is otherwise up.
Okay, thank you. I would respond as follows, that a rental car company can still be held liable for negligent entrustment.
Yes.
The insurer is not renting the car. It cannot be held liable for negligent entrustment. So when that occurs, it is just better for the public. It's better for the interests of the innocent injured people that the insurer not be able to avoid its liability by rescinding after the incident and the risk and the harm has occurred. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Abel. Hear now from Mr. St. George.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court.
Do you see a difference between the Barrera was a case, as I recall, where a person who owned a car, a privately owned car, contacted his insurance agent and asked for liability insurance. And it wasn't a car rental situation where you go to you stand in line, go to a desk, and so I guess my question to you is, do you see a distinction between the two contexts where in the rental context it's, you know, it, like I say, it's standing in line, hopefully getting a car as quickly as you can, and it's an area where the legislature has defined the obligation or the duty of the rental agent.
I do see a difference in the dual capacity of the rental agent, because when somebody comes in to rent the car, the agent, as the agent of the rental car company, discharges the duty imposed upon her by the vehicle code by inspecting the license. But then the same agent takes on the role of an agent for an insurance company, and she is selling an insurance excess liability policy in her capacity as the representative of an insurer. So in my opinion, there is a difference between as the agent for the rental company. She, in fact, by verifying the license, just looking at it, verifying the signature, discharges the duty imposed upon her by the vehicle code. Barrera stated that once you are selling liability insurance company, even if the applicant actively misrepresented the status of his license, if you don't conduct an investigation within a reasonable time, then if the accident happens and somebody is injured, you don't have the right to rescind. You have an affirmative duty. And the question that is certified by the Ninth Circuit is a very narrow one. The language of Barrera is all-inclusive. Repeatedly, Barrera says the duty to investigate the insurability of the driver within a reasonable time is imposed upon all insurers.
Well, let me ask you what the reasonable time was in Barrera. What does that mean? And that's one context. And then I would ask you, in the context of a rental car, what would a reasonable time be?
In Barrera, of course, the reasonable time, the events described in the Barrera case, incidentally, happened in 1958. And, of course, the time frame of Barrera was much longer than the time frame here. In Barrera, they had time to send letters and correspondence to the DMV. But I would submit that in today's day and age of computerization, the reasonable time within which you have to conduct an investigation is very short.
While the customer is standing at the desk?
Considering that at the scene of the accident, the police was able to determine the license was suspended within 3 minutes just by using a field computer, 3 minutes was not unreasonable for the police.
Well, are we anticipating that some person in a rental car company desk in an airport is going to have the same access to records as the police department are? And is that, do we want to set up a system of that nature as a matter of policy?
There is already a policy in California which requires that the insurance companies implement sometimes methods that actually it's in Barrera. The language of Barrera in footnote number 7 or 6 is saying that the insurer may be under a duty entirely irrespective of one which with the law imposes, regardless the company's desire to assume it.
That's very interesting, but it's not an answer to my question. My question was, are we assuming that a person at a rental car desk in an airport is going to have or should have the same degree of access to governmental records as the police department does?
I think it's not unreasonable, because I suppose that it can be implemented. A computer record can be programmed that way that the clerk can access the Department of Motor Vehicle Records. It's not unreasonable to expect that the insurance company can establish channels of communication with the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Aside from whether it can be done, as you responded to Justice Corrigan, should it be done? Aren't there some possible privacy interests where you might have a situation compromised with information that really wasn't needed by the rental company, and it's going to now be disclosed to it and its personnel?
Well, I suppose that private information should be guarded carefully, but the information that is put out by the DMV can be restricted to the status of the license. If somebody's license has been suspended, that could be posted on the website of the DMV, easy access for the rental car agency or the excess liability carrier, and other information would be restricted to law enforcement.
So we'd have to develop a system that just provided a special category of information for car rental agencies, let's say, that wouldn't be available, you know, in terms of putting everything out there to them.
I think that maybe we are focusing narrowly on whether we should do it through the Department of Motor Vehicles. There are maybe other methods of investigation. Barrera is not contemplating that the insurer must go to the DMV. Barrera is merely stating that the insurer is under a duty to investigate. Methods of investigation are not prescribed.
Well, what else can they do in the time allotted, other than check with DMV, which even then may not be permissible in the time allotted, or ask questions, which they may get false answers to? What else could they do?
Well, I'm just surmising, maybe an internet record search of possibly any violations of or being tried for violating the vehicle code. Or
what database would that come from?
Well, I'm at a loss to answer.
Well, I'm thinking that...
Yes.
If we were to agree with you and there is a Barrera duty in this context, the next question would be whether the duty in any particular circumstance had been breached. Am I right?
Yes.
And that has not been decided. Am I right?
Yes.
And in Barrera, as I understand it, it went on to say the reasonableness of the insurer's failure would depend on things like the accessibility of the information, the cost of obtaining it, the administrative burden, and whether the insurer had a practice of delaying investigation until presentation of a claim. So if we were to decide across the board that there is a Barrera-like duty, the contours of that duty would not be decided today. We wouldn't decide they have to instantaneously investigate, or they have 4 days, or they have to do it at close of business. Am I correct?
Yes, in a certain sense, Your Honor, but I submit that there is no need to decide that way, because Barrera already spoke on the issue. Barrera is inclusive of all insurers. That duty is already imposed upon all insurance companies, because to hold otherwise would mean that the language, the holding, would say it is the duty of all insurance companies to investigate within a reasonable time, unless you are selling excess liability insurance policy. Barrera doesn't say
that. Did the Ninth Circuit or counsel stipulate as to what the definition is of a rental car transaction? I mean, does this apply to a long-term rental transaction or long-term lease, or are you urging that the Barrera duty apply in each of those contexts?
Well, Your Honor, I suppose that this is exactly why we are here, because the Ninth Circuit felt that they needed guidance, and they asked the Supreme Court to provide their guidance.
Do you have a definition of rental car transaction that we can rely upon?
Well, I wouldn't volunteer one here today, but I think that when we talk about the different nature of the transaction of selling the policy to the driver or renting a car, as I indicated earlier, my opinion is that those are two different duties.
So is it correct to assume then that the amount of time that's available for the insurer's agent to investigate the driver's history is always very limited, or are there times when it can be more extended?
I think it's limited only by the time elapsing between the accident when they want to rescind the insurance. In the present case, the available time was five days, I'm sorry. Because this is the crux of the matter. You cannot rescind if you waited until somebody was injured. So the time is limited by the time when somebody actually gets injured. If you did not investigate, I would say that the duty, just to be prudent as an insurer, would be immediate. Start
investigating. Because someone could be injured as the driver's driving out the driveway.
I agree wholeheartedly. That's
you may answer, but otherwise your time is up, Mr. Singh.
I agree wholeheartedly, but that's even more reason for start investigating promptly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. St. George. We'll hear now from Mr. Green.
Before you get into any of the issues, I was waiting for an opening to ask a question. I was unable to do so earlier, so you're my victim, so to speak. I hope you can shed some light on this issue. As you know, the opposing side has relied very heavily on this court's decision in Barrera. And from the opposing side's standpoint, Barrera applies with equal force here. Now, taking a look at Barrera, you know and I know that there the court dealt with primary insurance coverage. This case, excess insurance coverage. Barrera did not deal with a rental company. This case deals with a rental company. And yes, I know that the opposing side has argued that doesn't make one whit of difference. Barrera says that when an insurance company issues a car liability policy, it has a duty to promptly investigate the insurability of the insured. And if the company fails to do so, it cannot come in later and say, oh, by the way, that person did not disclose certain things that would have convinced us not to issue an insurance policy. Now let's take a look at this case. Here we have a driver from Arizona going to the rental company and say, I would like to rent a car. He's asked for his license. Clerk of the rental company takes a look at the license and figured, seems okay. Signature seems okay. And under the law, that's all that is required of the person working for the rental company. The opposing side would have us hold that the excess insurer would have a duty beyond that of the rental company to, on its own, conduct an investigation as to, well, is there anything really wrong with the license? Shouldn't we call up Arizona and figure out, was this license suspended? As it turned out, it was. I would like to hear from you what your response is to the observations I've just made.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, there are two really good reasons why Barrera doesn't apply here, which we have, of course, set forth in our briefs. But first of all, Barrera was dealing, as Your Honor, the point you made was, with a primary policy issued to satisfy financial responsibility limits, and Barrera, throughout the entire decision, the Barrera court centered its holding around the fact that they were dealing with financial responsibility public policy, the public policy of the state of California that each driver is to have at least minimum insurance. And, of course, in this situation, that minimum insurance was provided by budget, separate and apart from the excess insurance that my client provided. And so we say that the public policy basis that was enunciated in Barrera does not apply to an excess policy. and particularly in the context which Your Honor mentioned also. And that context is that Barrera involved a regular consumer auto transaction, which is certainly not anywhere similar to a rental car transaction, in which we all know we come to the rental counter and the rental transaction is consummated within minutes, and many times the entire contract is performed in a single day. You fly in for a meeting or a court appearance, as I do from time to time, rent a car, drive to my destination, make my appearance, come back to the airport, turn in the car, and get on the airplane and go home all in one day. So the entire transaction many times occurs in one day. So this context, this commercial context, we believe has been recognized by the California legislature that it requires some special rules. And vehicle code sections 14604 and 14608 are very instructive there, because what those codes hold, first of all, 14604A says that the owner of a vehicle, that means any of us that own a vehicle, including a rental car company, the owner of a vehicle, if that person lends or turns the vehicle over to someone else to drive, has to determine whether or not that person has a valid driver's license. 14604A goes on and says, but the owner is only required to make reasonable efforts to determine that. And it goes on to say the owner doesn't have to check with the DMV.
So to summarize, your point is that it would be, from your perspective, it would be unfair to saddle the excess insurance carrier here with a duty that goes far beyond the duty imposed by the legislature on the rental company, where the rental company's obligations are simply to take a look at the driver's license presented, see whether it seems to be valid, compare the signature, et cetera, and to hold, as the opposing side has argued, that the insurance excess, that the excess insurer has a duty beyond that and have to conduct its own investigation is simply, from your standpoint, not contemplated by the legislature.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
One other point. Much or something or certain things have been said about the ease of finding out through the computer or whatever the information pertaining to a person's driver's license. Assuming for the moment that that indeed is true, wouldn't it be up to the legislature to amend the section pertaining to the duty of the rental company and to impose an additional duty other than just checking this piece of driver's license that's been presented, but also to conduct an additional check? And if that were required of the rental company, would your position be that, well, in that situation, you would have no problem if such a duty were imposed on the excess insurance?
Well, yeah, Your Honor, I think the bottom line would be that that whatever the legislature sets out that is required to qualify someone to rent a car, that's the same qualifications that are required for that person to obtain the excess insurance. The excess insurance is optional, but the only proviso being that the rental car company cannot enroll someone in this excess insurance policy unless that person has been first qualified to rent a car under the laws of the state.
Your comment touches on a point that it's very fundamental. I just want to establish it. You come up to the desk and you're going to rent a car, and you have a clerk there takes your driver's license, and that same clerk, I'm asking, serves as an agent for the insurance company and asks you what, or do you go off to a machine and buy your insurance? How does that work?
Well, this is a single transaction. The commercial context of it is that the rental counter clerk or agent, however you want to describe the person that rents the car, is not only handling the primary transaction, which is renting the car, but the incidental portions of the transaction, which also have to do with insurance. So there's not
serving,
a separate...
They're serving as, if you will, an agent of the insurance company.
A limited agent, yes.
And were we to do as your opponents ask, we would then impose on this clerk who has discharged her duty by asking for the driver's license and all additional duties at that time to investigate other aspects of this driver's eligibility on behalf of the insurance company.
That's correct, Your Honor. And moreover, if the additional duties that they're talking about were imposed on excess carriers, it would have a very negative effect on the availability of excess insurance at a rental counter because those of the practicalities of performing what they're talking about. As a matter of fact, you know, when my esteemed opponents talk about, well, maybe they could ask some questions at the rental counter apart from what they already asked. The Osborne case, which we cited in our papers, it was a negligent entrustment case. It wasn't an insurance case, but it talked about this same concept of what does the rental car company have to do at the counter? And they said, well, gosh, if you would ask about this guy's driving record, you might find out if you asked him, did he ever have a DUI? He might tell you that he did, and then you could just not rent to him because this guy ended up having an accident driving drunk. Well, of course, the court noted, no, we're not going to put that requirement on there. First of all, just as was discussed a few moments ago, you don't really expect necessarily someone's going to be real frank with you about that. But you know, when you're talking about a driver's license, I'm National Coverage Counsel for Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company and have been for over 10 years, and I've represented rental car companies since the early 1980s. And the kind of thing that happened here, where a renter came in and lied about his driver's license knowingly, which is what the court held after a trial of the court.
Would you agree that here the driver, in applying for a $1 million supplemental policy, was under no legal obligation to buy that supplemental coverage?
Absolutely not. It was optional. It's not required either by California statute or is it required by the rental car company in order to rent the car.
Of course, here the driver did buy the insurance, and unfortunately, after running through a red light, colliding with three or four vehicles. There were extremely serious injuries, and the facts pertaining to the claimants I find sympathetic. But your view is there was no legal obligation on the part of your client to conduct an investigation that went far beyond the investigation required of the rental company.
That is exactly my client's position, Your Honor. I would say, of course, that as a human being, I have sympathy for these folks, too. And no one likes to see someone get hurt in an accident.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Was the other vehicle insured, the victim's vehicle?
I don't know because I was not involved in the underlying, you know, personal injury lawsuit. If you're getting at whether or not they had uninsured motorist coverage,
yes, I'm.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
I guess my question, just to verify my understanding, uninsured motorist protection is mandatory, is it not, when one buys a liability policy?
Uninsured motorist coverage up to minimum statutory limits.
Yes.
There's no obligation for it to be purchased or offered above that, though.
But any driver in California, anyone that owns a car in California, does have the obligation, I guess, to have insurance and does have the option to have excess uninsured motorist protection. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And I take it that in this case, either there wasn't insurance or at least the uninsured motorist coverage was equal to budgets coverage?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that because it wasn't an issue in our case. And I do know that budgets, statutory limits, have been partially paid to some of the folks and have been tendered to the others. Then they're waiting to go ahead and accept it pending the outcome of this appeal. But the full $30,000 that's required by law was not only available, but it's been paid partially and then tendered otherwise. So the public policy that the California legislature has enunciated requiring financial responsibility limits was met in this case, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about above this, something that's not required by law.
Would there be coverage if the misrepresentation was innocent as opposed to negligent or willful?
That was the issue that we tried. Whether or not, and Judge Liu ruled that under the law he felt that there had to either be knowing misrepresentation or that the individual didn't have any reasonable basis for making the representation that the driver's license was valid that he handed to the rental counter clerk. And Judge Liu, after hearing all the evidence, which I will not go through unless the court would like me to, but I certainly can do it, found both prongs. He found that Mr. Burke either knew, actually, that driver's license was suspended at the time he presented it, or he, at the very least, had no reasonable basis to believe it was valid because he had a history of several prior suspensions of his license in Arizona, and he had had another accident and had been given a court date. Each time before, when he was given a court date, he blew off and did not attend the court date, never showed up, and each time his driver's license was suspended, and each time then after the statutory period he would get it reinstated. In this instance, he did exactly the same thing. He was given a court date, and he didn't appear, and that was several months prior to this rental. So Judge Liu found he either knew it or, in the alternative, he had no reasonable basis to believe that his license was
valid.
Are there
some types of misrepresentations, whether negligent or innocent, that might not come up on any kind of DMV investigation?
Well, that's true. And, I'd like to comment on that. First of all, counsel made a comment, and this I have to say goes a little bit outside the record because it wasn't put into evidence at the trial, but he mentioned the Interstate Compact that 45 states that are involved in. Interstate Compact is for public use only. It's not for private use. That's how the police officer was able to determine whether
Mr. Green, picking up on Justice Marino's question of what if certain information wouldn't come up. From your standpoint, what harm would there be were this court to say, yes, there is a duty to investigate, but it's a reasonable, timely duty? And then you look to the circumstances of the case, and this duty would not, well, you could do whatever you could quickly do if you have the resources at the desk, but say you don't, and it's a turnaround rental and it's over by the end of the day, but something's occurred. Why not look at it that, yes, you have a duty, but then you look to whether you've breached it, and the breach would depend on the availability of the information, the access that the budget clerk would have on a machine, et cetera.
Well, Your Honor, in Barrera, we were talking about a financial responsibility policy that was subject to the public policy, and the legislature had already spoken on that. In this instance, the legislature has spoken and drawn a bright line between the public policy applying to financial responsibility limits policies not applying to excess policies.
Well, I'm not sure I follow you. The financial responsibility limits are to compensate at a minimum level. Certainly that's not the public policy. That's the maximum level. It's to assure that at least an injured party gets that much. Is there some public policy that precludes compensating them for more if the driver has sought to get more coverage?
Oh, there's nothing that precludes it, but the converse is that the legislature has not seen fit to require it. And this would be an extension. A good example of it is in the insurance code, section 11580.1. That statute sets out on a financial responsibility limits policy, it sets out precisely the coverage that's required and then enumerates the exclusions that can be in that type of a policy. But the statute goes on and says, for any portion of the limits of the coverage that's above financial responsibility limits, none of these restrictions apply. And for any portion of the limits that's in a, or if it's an excess policy above financial responsibility limits, none of these restrictions apply. And the court in Hertz versus Home Insurance, which was a DUI case where a person rented a car from Hertz, went out, got drunk, and had an accident. And the coverage, the rental agreement, as well as the excess coverage said, we exclude driving under the influence. And what the court did in applying section 11580.1 is said, look, we have a strong public policy requiring at least financial responsibility limits, and people driving around there have a right to expect that everybody else will have that. So we're going to say that up to the extent of financial responsibility limits, your exclusion for driving under the influence is void. But above that, it's not, because 11581.1 says that the public policy doesn't extend above minimum financial responsibility limits. So I believe that the legislature has drawn this bright line, and that Barrera just simply didn't contemplate this situation. It was talking about financial responsibility limits policies. Moreover, we have a situation where the legislature has spoken on what it thinks is appropriate to be inquired into and what duty we have at the rental counter in order to check a driver's license. And if the legislature sees fit to require more than that, then certainly to the extent that the excess insurers at the rental counter rely upon the rental counter clerks to qualify a renter, they're going to have to live with that, whatever the legislature says. But I believe that sending this back on a Barrera type reasoning would be invading the province of the legislature in those two respects, because the legislature has drawn those lines already.
So your concern would be, as we consider how we're going to resolve this case, that we speak only to the rental car context and not to excess liability insurance in the regular consumer transaction.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Mr. St. George, my worthy opponent, pointed that out, that this is a very narrow question that was certified to the court. This is not asking the court to make some kind of broad sweeping statement. It's limited to the rental car context and excess insurance in that context.
Oh, and I would, since there's a silence here, I would like you to speak to a question Justice Moreno addressed earlier. What is the definition of rental? Does this involve a long-term lease? Some people never buy a car. They're leasing one. Mm-hmm. It could be a six-week vacation, or it could be a single-day turnaround trip.
Right, and of course, this was not something that was included within the record, so I'm speaking only to answer your question from my prior experience. In the rental car industry, a rental of a car refers to a transaction that occurs that cannot be longer than 30 days, whereas a lease refers to something that's longer than that. And we are not talking about long-term lease transactions here at all. That's a completely different situation than what we're talking about. We're talking about a short-term rental. A few of them last out to 30 days, but, you know, that's a pretty expensive way to get use of a car for that long a period of time. Most rental car transactions occur within a few days at the most, and it's
so
fully performed.
Everything you've stated is in the context of something not to exceed 30 days?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the rental car context that I'm familiar with.
I assume that if you, if the agent were to receive a license describing the individual as 6'4" and the renter is 5'2", the fact that he accepts and receives and photocopies that license isn't going to get him off the hook.
Might be a problem. I mean, there's, you know, you can envision when you know, circumstances that are so extreme that someone might not be able to fall back on the safe harbor of the statute. I think that those things are very rare. I was starting to comment earlier that I've done this kind of work across the country for a long time, and you'd be surprised how rare we have the kind of situation like we have in this case where somebody just comes up and outright lies about whether their license is valid.
But
just doesn't happen that often.
In this case, it was the renter's license.
Yes, it was.
And the license was facially valid.
Yes, it was. Absolutely. And it's uncontroverted that the rental counter clerk performed all of the requirements under the statutes, which include 14604 and 14608, but one more that we didn't talk about that's part of the trilogy of statutes, and that's 14609, that requires that the rental car company record the information and maintain it, record the information about the driver, the driver's license number, the address, and that sort of thing. And that was made a part of the record showing that Budget had, in fact, done that. We respectfully believe that the court should answer the certified question no, and would ask that the court do that. I guess maybe there's one, and it dovetails with much of what we've been talking about. There's one other subject, if I have a couple of moments, that I might address, and that is reasonable expectations doctrine that was addressed in Barrera and was addressed in my worthy opponent's briefing. The reasonable expectations doctrine was cited as part of the basis in Barrera, but that's because we were talking about in Barrera financial responsibility limits policy, and as I commented earlier, that's what each of us as drivers on the road have the right to expect that other drivers will obey the law and will have the minimum statutorily required coverage. But there is no reasonable expectation that there would be coverage not required by law above that. And each of the appellants were occupants of one of two other vehicles involved in this accident. They weren't occupants of the rental car and had no knowledge of the rental car transaction and therefore couldn't possibly have a reasonable expectation that there would be excess coverage. Their only reasonable expectation would be the one that all the rest of us have of other drivers, that is that the car would have financial responsibility limits on it, and it did in fact have them, and Budget has in fact provided them. So for all these reasons, we would respectfully ask the court to answer the certified question no.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Green. And we'll hear now from Mr. Abel by way of rebuttal.
I would like to address first the issue of the reasonable expectation. The reasonable expectation that was articulated in Barrera, and I think that is generally accepted, is that an insurance company will meet its basic commitment, that is to provide insurance. And that expectation to provide insurance is the insurance that it promised to provide. And if you go back and look at the analysis that Barrera did, it was founded on two issues. One, the underlying policy. The underlying policy to protect and innocent people and provide compensation. The minimum financial responsibility limits, as Justice Werdiger pointed out, are the minimums. They're not the maximum. And unfortunately, the legislature has not seen fit to go back and change that since the mid-1960s. So it's 15 and 30 and 19 in the middle of the 1960s, and it's still that today. But the policy, the overriding policy, is to provide compensation. It is not to limit the coverage. It is not to minimize and say, an insurance company, if you offered a $100,000, $300,000 policy, our policy is that you only have to, when the accident occurs, if there's some kind of reason that you think you can get out of it, only pay the minimum. Now, a case, and the other issue is that there's a distinct difference between a rental car company and an insurance company. Insurance companies are deemed to be quasi-public entities. They serve a public service. A rental car company does not. This court, which I think is well aware, is not to rewrite statutes, nor to insert what is missing. In the rental car statutes, it doesn't say one word about insurance companies.
Are they or are they not agents of the insurance company for this purpose? Rental car companies.
Yeah, they're either agents or independent contractors.
They're acting on behalf of the insurance.
That's correct. That every single person that rents a car is offered insurance. That's all that's required. You're going to rent the car? Here's some insurance for you. And that insured leaves the lot, and before he leaves the lot, I should say, has an expectation that he's got $1 million coverage.
But if they're agents acting on behalf of the insurance company, shouldn't we treat them as we would an insurance company or not?
Well, they're not actually considered the insurer. Cases have distinguished between rental car companies that could be held liable, for example, as I previously indicated, for negligent entrustment, but the insurer cannot. And if the car is rented to someone, whether knowingly or not, to someone that doesn't have a valid license, it's the rental car company that can be held liable for the infraction if they didn't know, but if they knew, for a misdemeanor. But not the insurance company. So there are distinctions between them, and we should not blur the distinction merely because the legislature has decided to impose an obligation on a non-quasi-public entity to do certain things to rent a car.
Mr. Abel, right after Mr. Green made his argument pertaining to the applicability or lack of applicability of the reasonable expectations of the insured, you responded to that. And I think in the course of your argument, you noted the financial responsibility law. Of course, as we know, that was an issue in Barrera. And of course, here, we're not dealing with the financial responsibility law, but with excess insurance. And if I recall Mr. Green's argument correctly, in the course of questioning from the bench, he noted that in this particular case, the driver was under no legal obligation to buy supplemental insurance of $1 million. And I think Mr. Green's point in the course of his argument was the claimants here, although we all agree the facts in this particular case, the accident naturally is sympathetic. But Mr. Green's point was, because the driver was under no legal obligation to buy a $1 million insurance policy and could have simply stuck with the regular minimum amounts required by law, the claimants, according to Mr. Green, are no better off than if Mr. Burke, the driver, had never bought that $1 million insurance policy?
I would say, on the other hand, the insurance company is not obligated to offer the insurance. They are voluntarily entering that market and with that context in mind. So that once it does do that, the person who buys the insurance has a right to expect the coverage promised. When a contract is entered into, it is presumed that it will be performed by each party.
Why does he have a right to expect that when he has deceived the agent of the company?
I would say that for the same underlying reasons that Barrera held, that even if there's an intentional misrepresentation, the insured had the right to have the coverage, at least with respect to the injured party. The insurer is not left without a right. The insurer can still sue the insurer and say, you lied it, you cheated, and we're going to hold you responsible. So in Barrera, it indicated even if they're outright lied, the insurance company still has an obligation because it didn't investigate it. And it should have, because it's a quasi-public entity, and we impose that duty for the welfare of the people of the state of California.
Parties? What about the person who made the misrepresentation?
No. In as I understood Barrera, it said the insured cannot sue the insurance company successfully, or at least that the insurance company could defend on fraud, or alternatively, the insurance company could sue the insured for making the misrepresentation.
So there's no duty to investigate that goes to the person taking out the insurance, only to third parties?
No, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. At least that's not what Barrera said. And I think the duty to investigate is a result of considering and weighing the impact of allowing people to be out driving the streets and highways with a potentially voidable policy versus, on the other hand, protecting those people who suffer grave injuries. And the weight of that strong public interest dictates that there be at least the duty to investigate. Just what that is and whether or not it's been satisfied in a particular circumstance is, as Barrera noted, a question of fact.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Abel. Your time is up. Thank you, Mr. St. George. Thank you, Mr. Green. The matter stands submitted.